Go ahead, turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 3. We're in a study series based on the book of Hebrews called Sacred Spaces. And to get us thinking about the topic for today, I'd like to read some words to a song that Rabbi Zacharias references in a book called Can Man Survive Without God? And he actually, he opens the book with this, with the words to this, these songs and to this song. And it was kind of what began to get him moving towards actually ultimately finding Christ. And the words go read as follows. From the canyons of my mind, we wander on and stumble blind, wade through the often tangled maze of starless nights and sunless days, hoping for some kind of clue, a road to lead us to the truth. But who will answer? Is our hope in walnut shells worn round the neck with temple bells, or deep within some cloistered walls where hooded figures pray in shawls, or high upon some dusty shelves, or in the stars, or in ourselves? Who will answer? If the soul is darkened by a fear it cannot name, if the mind is baffled when the rules don't fit the game, who will answer? Who will answer? Who will answer? Kind of a happy song, isn't it? But in a sense, that was the question that the readers of Hebrews were asking. These first century Christian Jews, you remember, that were living in or near Rome were beginning to feel the pain and the pinch of religious opposition. Now, we learn later in the letter that no one had yet died for their faith in that little community at this point. In other words, persecution had not yet reached its peak. But things were starting to get worse, and they were beginning to struggle with starless nights and sunless days of uncertainty and fear in ways that I think are almost impossible for us to imagine. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a place where, you know, I couldn't find work because of my faith. I can't imagine, you know, dealing with, you know, the fact that my wife or my children, you know, I might come home and find out that they had been taken from me. Or I can't imagine I myself being maybe arrested and then tortured for my faith. I can't imagine. But the first readers of Hebrews, they didn't have to imagine because that was their reality. Some of you know this, maybe probably most of you don't. Joan and I were actually in Rome a couple of weeks before Easter. Actually, we were in Rome on Palm Sunday. And when we were there, we stayed just a short walk from all the iconic ruins of the Roman Empire, including the Colosseum. You know the building that I'm talking about? And it was just a sobering thought to realize that the first readers of Hebrews lived in the shadow of that massive stadium that could hold 65, 75, maybe even 80,000 people. Just this huge, massive stadium. And in fact, it was probably being constructed when this letter was being delivered. And so some of these folks would look out their window and they're wondering, you know, I wonder what they're going to do with that. And as you know, eventually Christians were killed and tortured and ripped apart by wild animals for the entertainment of the masses in that Colosseum. Which kind of helps us explain the words that we left off with last week. And before we get into chapter 3, I want you to just look back at the last two verses that Jeremiah took us through last week. Look at verses 17 and 18. Where the writer says, therefore, he, that is Jesus, had to be made like his brethren in all things, that he might become a merciful and high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation or atonement for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. In other words, Jesus didn't come to earth insulated from the human experience of pain and suffering. He knows exactly what it is that we are up against in a fallen world, and he feels for us. And best of all, notice what he says, he comes to our aid. And the idea there is that of run to the cry, like a parent, towards a hurting child. You come to the aid. And he's saying that when I'm ambushed by pain and suffering and tempted to despair and doubt, he runs to my cry. In other words, when I cry, who will answer? The writer of Hebrews says, Jesus. He understands our pain, our suffering. He knows exactly how we feel. George Mueller said, be assured, if you walk with him and look to him and expect help from him, he will never fail you. As an older brother who has known the Lord for 44 years, who writes this, says to you for your encouragement that he has never failed him. In the greatest difficulties, in the heaviest trials, in the deepest poverty and necessities, he has never failed me. But because I was enabled by his grace to trust him, he has always appeared for my help. And he says, I delight in speaking well of his name. So with that backdrop now we're ready to come into chapter 3. And the chapter division is a little bit unfortunate because what we read in chapter 3 actually flows from what he just said in chapter 2. But I want you to notice the very first word in verse 1 of chapter 3. He says, therefore. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. He says, therefore, meaning what? Meaning in light of or in response to what I have just written, this is the application. Because of who Jesus is, this is what you should do when life is hard or lonely or painful or uncertain. And he sums it up with just two words in my version. Some versions say, fix your thoughts on. My version says, two words, consider Jesus. Really? Consider Jesus? I mean, at first blush, that just sounds like a useless cliche, doesn't it? It's like, putting a Band-Aid on a brain hemorrhage. I know you're in the crucible of pain and suffering, but have you considered Jesus? Nothing seems more obvious or less helpful. But there's nothing in the word consider that suggests a cliche. It means to think deeply. Literally, it means to perceive down. To think so as to get under the surface of things so that you really understand. Which, of course, is what most people will not do. Someone has said 5% of the people think, 15% of the people think they think, 80% of the people would rather die than think. Someone else says, sadly, for some Christians, you can walk through the waters of their deepest thoughts and not get your ankles wet. And I wonder if one of the reasons that we don't handle trials and difficulties and afflictions and dark days in life very well is because we're not engaged in the rigorous mental discipline of thinking about Jesus. And it is striking to me that those who seem to have faced the greatest trials best are those who have thought about Jesus the most. At least that's the impression I'm left with when I read church history and you read books about the martyrs and some of those who died for their Christian faith through the centuries and right up until the modern world. Here's one example. Sir Thomas More was about to be hanged. He prayed to God and trusted in the Father's mercy, and as More was being led up to the scaffold, he smiled at his executioner. And he said, will you help me up, if you please? Coming down, I can shift for myself. And Steve Brown, who tells the story, says the only way More could have said that was because he had already died to the world. And he says, this year I want to die a little more to the things of the world so that when my time comes, it won't be a great problem to do what I have already done. That kind of response to affliction and trial and death doesn't come automatically. It comes from thinking deeply about Jesus. And if we take time, if we consider Jesus, what will we find? And the writer helps us. He gives us two things. He says Jesus is our apostle, our sent one, and our priest. In other words, when you consider Jesus in your world of pain and suffering, you will find that he has been sent forth by the Father, and you will realize that he is your high priest. In other words, Jesus is not some kind of cold, distant, unconcerned messenger. He not only came, he was sent forth by the Father, but he's also a compassionate high priest. He cares. And not only that, and then starting in verse 2, he takes a totally unexpected change in emphasis. Look where he goes next, and you're going to wonder about it. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all of his house. That's weird. Out of the clear blue, he brings Moses into this. Why does he bring up Moses? Why in the world does he bring Moses into this? Because these are Jewish Christians. They follow Jesus, but they trace their roots back to Judaism. They come from a tradition of revering Moses. Moses was like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. In one person for the Jews. He was the father and the emancipator of the nation. And for a Jew, it was impossible to conceive of anybody who was closer to God than Moses. And even more to the point, Moses was starting to look pretty good to these Jewish Christians. Because as it becomes apparent, and as the letter unfolds, we find out that as persecution increased, some of them were thinking about turning back to their old way of life and abandoning the faith that was causing them grief. And they began to think, maybe Moses is the answer. Life will be easier, they thought, if we go back to following Moses rather than Jesus. And that was true. Because Judaism was a tolerated religion within the Roman Empire. For whatever reason, they allowed Judaism. There was like 15,000 Jews in Rome at this time. And if they had gone back to Judaism, they would have been safe. But Christianity was a cult, and later it will become a threat to the Roman Empire. So that's part of the reason that they're being persecuted. So without disparaging Moses, the writer, he not so subtly says, just stop and think about it. Look at verses 3 through the first part of 6. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, but just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every home is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all of his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house. And he says, whose house we are. Now he uses this word house 7 times in 5 verses. So we need to talk a little bit about what it means. If you ask most people, where's the house of God? Most people would say what? Well, they'd point to a church building. Ask a Jew, where is the house of God? And he'll tell you it's the temple. People tend to think of a place of worship as God's house. And we do that as well. But here, it's a word picture for God's people. God's people are the house of God. So when you read house, read God's people or household of faith. But what's his point? And he has 3 points here, 3 points. First, he says Moses was a part of the house, but Jesus was its architect and its builder. In other words, we admire buildings. We see a beautiful building, or house or whatever, and we admire that, but we understand that the one who really is deserving of the honor is the architect or the builder. And so he says, while Moses may be admired for his part among the household of faith, it's Jesus. He's the one that ought to be exalted because he's the one that built it. He's the one that put it all together. And then second, Moses knew God personally, but Jesus is God permanently. And you see that in verses 3 and 4. The builder worthy of honor in verse 3 is who? Jesus. But the builder of all things in verse 4 is who? God. In other words, while Moses was an extraordinary man, he was just a man. Jesus, however, is deity. He is Lord over all, and he is to be worshipped and obeyed. And then his third point is this. Moses was faithful in his house as a servant, but Jesus was faithful in his house as the Son. Servants, even really good ones, come and go. But Jesus is the permanent Son of God. He reigns, he remains forever. In other words, he says, you may be thinking about returning to Moses, and you may think he's the answer to your problems, but think again. Moses was a great leader. He was a fine man. He was a faithful servant, but Jesus was the Messiah. He is the Son of God that Moses was pointing us to. He's saying, it's not Moses that you want to turn to. It's Jesus. Now, I wish there was a period here, but there's a comma. And look at the second part of the verse 6. He says, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. What do you mean if? It reads as if our place in the household of faith depends upon our being able to hold on fast until the end, which in a sense is true, but it's really tricky to explain. One writer said that's why the writer didn't sign the letter. He was too chicken to identify himself. But the way it reads, it sounds as if you don't hold firm, it's possible to lose your place in the family. It's possible to lose your salvation. But I assure you, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying that we can lose our salvation, nor that we can lose our place in God's family. And here's why. One writer puts it this way. You cannot reverse salvation. You can't reverse your new birth into God's family any more than you can reverse your first birth into your biological family. It is a fixed reality. When you become a Christian, you become a new creation permanently. You're not some kind of Jekyll and Hyde that slips back and forth between old and new. The Holy Spirit takes up residence within us, and he doesn't keep his bags packed by the door so that when we mess up, he leaves. And finally, our salvation doesn't depend upon our weak grasp on God. It's dependent on his firm grip on us. And in John 10, he promises that he will never let us go. Okay, so then what is he saying? Well, I agree with F.F. Bruce, who puts it this way. Continuance is the proof of reality. Continuance is the proof of reality. If you want proof of a reality, check out a person's life at the end. Don't just look at like an initial response or some little segment of life where all of us slip up and fall at various times in our growth. Look at the whole life, at life as a whole. Because continuance is the proof of reality. In other words, the conditional clause begs a question. If you're thinking about walking away from the faith, if you're thinking about going back to your old way of life, then you need to ask whether or not you're really in the family. And that's a fair question. Remember what Paul wrote to the Corinthians? He says, test yourselves to see if you're in the faith. Examine yourselves. In other words, make sure your faith is real. You know, just knowing the lingo, just kind of going through the motions isn't enough. That will not sustain you when trials and afflictions and troubles come in life. Jesus talked about this in Matthew 13. Remember the parable of the sower, the four different kinds of soils that are there. And he talked about the plant that looked good on the outside, and it looked like it would produce a crop. The only trouble was it had no root. Well, so then when the heat of affliction came up, it proved the reality, the true condition of the plant. Which, as it turns out, for people is a matter of the heart. And that's where the writer goes next. He gets to the heart of the matter. And the writer asks his readers and us to take a look at our hearts, not the fist-sized mass of, you know, muscle and tissue, you know, that's inside of our body that, you know, pumps life through our body, but the heart of our inner person, the part of us that responds to God. And he wants to warn us about a great danger, a danger that is greater than any physical disease of the heart. It's a spiritual condition of cardiac calcification called hardness of heart. Look at verses 7 and 8. He says, therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness. Those words were instantly familiar to the first readers of Hebrews who were Jewish Christians. They knew exactly what they referred to. After the Exodus from Egypt, Moses led the people of Israel towards the promised land of Canaan. Remember that? Now, let me ask you a Jeopardy kind of question. Are you ready for this? Get your little buzzers ready. The Awana Bible champions, they would know the answer to this just like that. Here it is. Middle Eastern geography for $500. The shortest distance in a straight line from point A to point B should have taken the Israelites 11 days. I'll read it again. The shortest distance in a straight line from point A to point B should have taken the Israelites 11 days. Answer? What is Egypt to Canaan? But I thought Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They did. Then why in the world did it take them 40 years to travel what should have taken less than 2 weeks? You ever thought about this? Well, I'll tell you. Well, it wasn't because the Israelites lost their map. It wasn't because Moses was lost. Let me put up a slide for you. Is it up there? There we go. At the risk of validating the male stereotype, no, I don't want to stop and ask him for directions. Okay, here's another one. We have some tough sledding this morning, so let me just lighten it up. Steve Brown tells this story. He says, President George Bush died and went to heaven and found that it is a wonderful place. The people were friendly, the food was great, the gold streets were magnificent. But to the president's consternation, there was one man who simply wouldn't speak to him. After rather a long time, President Bush decided to fix the relational problem. He went over to the man and said, sir, my name is George Bush, and I hope I haven't done anything to offend you. I know I'm a Republican, but political differences shouldn't matter here. And the man said, no, that isn't the problem. My name is Moses, and the last time I talked to a bush, it cost me 40 years in the wilderness. Steve Brown says, he says, no point, just a funny story. He says, sometimes Christians need to laugh just because something is funny. Okay, but here's the deal. Back to this. I digress. The problem wasn't that Moses wouldn't stop and ask for directions. The problem was what we might call a callous condition of the heart, what the psalmist calls a case of hardened hearts. After Israel left Egypt, God put the people on a treadmill for a series of stress tests in order to prepare them for entering the promised land. And you remember, they failed miserably and repeatedly. For 40 years, they whined and complained and grumbled. They forgot what God had saved them from. They blamed him for what he had brought him to. Someone has said, to err is human. To blame it on God is even more human. They turned the tables. They put God on trial. And what did they keep wanting to do? Ouch. They kept wanting to return and to go back to their old way of life. Instead of being responsive to God, they were rebellious. And God was patient and he was long-suffering, but there is a point at which patience ceases to be a virtue. And as a result of their obstinate, stubborn, rebellious hearts, instead of entering God's rest, they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Verse 9. Where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years, and therefore I was angry with the generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Now, the writer takes up this whole concept of rest in earnest in the next chapter, and we're going to get to that next week. But for now, here's the crucial point to understand. When we're faced with a test or an obstacle or a trial or difficulty in life that looks insurmountable, God simply asks for just one simple thing. He asks for a surrendered heart. Just a surrendered heart. You remember how Psalm 23 goes, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And one commentator makes this observation. God's rest is like green pastures and quiet waters where the good shepherd wants to lead his fearful sheep. God tells his anxious sheep, if there is an obstacle you can't climb over, crawl under, or walk around, wait for me, rest in me. Whatever dried up stream you come to, whatever giant you face, cease striving and know that I am God. Another writer, I don't know who wrote this, she writes this. She says, while my husband and I were living in Pakistan many years ago, our six-month-old baby died. An old Punjabi who heard of our grief came to comfort us. A tragedy like this is similar to being plunged into boiling water, he explained. If you are an egg, your affliction will make you hard-boiled and unresponsive. If you are a potato, you will emerge soft and pliable, resilient and adaptable. And she says, it may sound funny to God, but there are many times when I have prayed, oh Lord, let me be a potato. So in trials, we can be an egg or we can be a potato. When affliction comes, we can let our hearts get hard, or we can be like a potato, soft and resilient and compliant. And let's go on, verse 12. Down to almost the end. We're going to move a little faster now. Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. And what he's going to go on, just so you know this, he's going to go on and tell us God is going to give us the grace to hold on. That's kind of the rest of the book. While it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they should not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? See what he's saying there? He's saying that what happened to the people of Israel in the wilderness could happen to you. Don't fall into the trap of the Israelites. He says, instead, as followers of Jesus, encourage each other to hold fast to the assurance that you have, which is precisely what the Israelites failed to do. They lost their grip on the assurance that God was with them, that God would provide for them and protect them, and they became stubborn and defiant and resistant and resentful and willfully disobedient. And sadly, As a result, they missed out on the blessing of God's rest, which was for them the promised land. And his point is, if that could happen to them, it could happen to you. And it doesn't matter how good God has been to you or how you've seen him work or how close you walk, over time, a tender heart can turn to stone if the conditions are right and the response is wrong. And that's why it's so important, he says, to encourage each other day by day. Encourage each other. That can be, it's a mutual commitment. And it can be as simple as a smile. It can be as complicated as a hard conversation. Chuck Swindoll says, exhorting others is like lighting small fires in people's lives. Sometimes the fires illumine sin, drawing people towards repentance. Sometimes they awaken sleepers, stirring them to action. Sometimes they warm weary travelers, comforting them with biblical truth. And sometimes they spark failing hearts, encouraging them with hope. And then he wraps it up with this, verse 19. And so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Please notice he doesn't say not willing. He says not able. It becomes a case of not simply saying, I don't want to. It came to a place where they were unable to. It came to a point of no return. They crossed the line where they missed out on the blessing that God had for them. And I didn't say there was no grace or there was no forgiveness left on God's part, but they missed out on the blessing of God's rest. They went through a series of tests and they never knew which one would be the last. But it finally came and they missed out. And you don't know what blessings you might miss or lose in life if you continue in hardness of heart. What are the signs of a hardness of heart? Warren Wiersbe helps us in his book, Real Worship. He says, what are some of the marks of a hard heart? And he gives us a list. An unwillingness to admit and confess my own sins. A bitter spirit toward another believer. An unwillingness to forgive. A resistance to the word of God, an inflexible attitude that cannot be taught or changed. A feeling that my way is the right way and the only way. A fear of change and an unwillingness to learn new things. A refusal to let people get too close. A touchiness of spirit, a supersensitive attitude that makes it difficult for people to get along with me. Being preoccupied with my own needs and not being concerned about the needs of others. And please note, three times in the text he says, today. In other words, there's a sense of urgency about this. Today is the day to deal with this. You know what the first sign of most heart attacks is? Death. There's no warning. You don't have any warning. And so the writer, in a sense, is saying it's time to start dealing with a spiritual heart. The time to start dealing with a spiritual heart condition is today. And so don't say it doesn't matter or I'll deal with this later. It matters to God. It matters to others. And it should matter to you. There are cascading consequences that are absolutely impossible to calculate. What he's saying is that unbelief is serious business. For the Christian, unbelief shuts the gate to the green pastures and the still waters of God's rest. And unbelief for the non-Christian bars the entrance to heaven. When we come to Christ, God gives us a new heart. We get a new heart. What a terrible tragedy, what a terrible loss it is if we allow that heart to grow hard. And in the same vein, when adversity strikes, turning back to your old way of life, whether it's Moses or anything else, isn't the answer. About 20 years ago, a little less than 20 years ago, I was with our youngest daughter, Bethany. And at the time, she was like 6 or 7 years of age. And one evening, we came out of Borders Bookstore. You remember when Borders used to be at the entrance to the mall there at, you know, 38th and Tacoma Mall Boulevard? And she was maybe 6 or 7 years of age. And I miss her. She lives on the East Coast, but she listens to her daddy's messages every week when she's cleaning house, which is way better than the young woman who told me one time, "I listen to your messages when I go to bed because they help me go to sleep." Okay. Now he listens to my messages, and I told her I was going to tell a story about her this morning. But, and if you know Bethany, it's just as cute as you can imagine it. You know, out of the blue, we're walking out of the store. We're just out of the entrance. And she says, "Daddy, that sign is right." And I look around. I don't see any sign of any significance. I said, "Honey, what did you just say?" And she said, "That sign is right." And so again, I'm looking around. I don't know what she's talking about. And I didn't know what she was referring to. And so I said, "Honey, what sign?" And she pointed across the street, and she said, "That sign." Do you know what sign I'm talking about? That says, used to say, "Christ is the answer," right? "Christ is the answer." And I said, "Honey, you're right. That sign is true. Now it says Jesus cares." And that's true too, just so you know. Christ is the answer. Now that sounds like a useless cliche, but it's not. But you might have to think about it for a while. When Isaac Newton was asked how he discovered the law of gravity, do you know what he said? "By thinking about it all the time." What do you think about? You think about that.